question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Monday, July 2nd, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Enrique Peña Nieto declares victory in Mexico. We'll examine the election results and what's behind the recent coup in Paraguay. Plus, author J.R. Helton on his new book titled Drugs. But I can't help myself,
why should I? This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. A preliminary vote count in Mexico shows that presidential candidate Enrique Peña Nieto is the winner, capturing 38% of the vote in yesterday's elections. Nieto celebrated last night at the headquarters of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, in Mexico City, declaring victory and telling voters, "You have given our party a second chance and we will deliver results." The PRI held Mexico's presidency and dominated politics for 71 years, ending in 2000 after years of accusations that the party was corrupt, authoritarian, and undemocratic. The left-of-center candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador has been found to have captured 31% of the vote. However, López Obrador has declined to concede the race until all votes are counted. The incumbent National Action Party's Vázquez Mota won 25% of the vote and has conceded defeat. The PAN held Mexico's presidency for the past 12 years. Enrique Peña Nieto had led the polls for weeks leading up to yesterday's elections. However, many analysts commented that the polls did not effectively capture non-traditional voters. In fact, Nieto won a smaller percentage of the vote than polls predicted. Also leading up to the elections were documented cases of media bias and widespread instances of vote buying. López Obrador, who lost a 2006 presidential bid by less than 1%, had stationed supporters at every single polling place to observe the voting. My guest is Laura Carlson. She is the director of the Mexico City-based Americas program of the Center for International Policy. She's also a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. She joins us now live from Mexico. Welcome to Uprising, Laura.
Good morning, Sonali. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, how do you assess the results yesterday? It was clear from the official polls that Nieto was likely to win. However, many people we had talked to said that the polls weren't effectively capturing young people, many people in rural communities. Were you surprised by yesterday's results?
No, I wasn't surprised by them. I think the fact that the margin was quite a bit closer than the polls predicted is another indication of one of the major accusations during the electoral period, which was that the polls were in many cases bought by candidates, and that there was an overall effort to try to present Peña Nieto's candidacy as a fait accompli that was then encouraged people to vote for him and also would inhibit the opposition vote. But it wasn't a huge surprise. However, it's been very disappointing to watch this. This is the fifth time I've been in Mexico observing and analyzing the presidential elections. And what I saw during this election period was not a new PRI. In fact, there's evidence all over the internet and in the news from independent media, from citizens groups, that the PRI relied heavily on old-style PRI machinery and dirty tricks in order to win this election. And not just on the day of the elections, but starting way back in 2009 and maybe earlier, grooming its candidate, creating a favorable publicity context in which to begin convincing people that he would be the next president of Mexico. The Electoral Institute in the 2006 elections that were only half a percentage point, as you mentioned, ended up denying a recount of the votes, a manual count of the votes, using just a tally sheet, on the basis of the fact that they had found some irregularities, but they wouldn't have changed the results. So you can imagine that despite the irregularities that have been documented, the response this time is going to be the same with quite a bit larger margin.
Right, but last time there was about a 1% margin. This time some reports are saying a 5% margin.
Yeah, even in the PREP, which is preliminary results that I'm looking at right now, it's about 6% now, which again is reflecting something that we saw last time, which was kind of a somewhat mysterious, at least to me, surgence of the official candidate, last time, of course, it was the PAN, this time the PRE, at the end of the polling. And last time there were a lot of accusations of manipulation in the computer system. This time, of course, it could just be a result of what votes come in first and what votes come in last. But most of the night, the margin was only 3%.
Now, what about these allegations that we heard leading up to the election of vote-buying mass instances where there were debit cards from certain businesses that were being handed out in exchange for people's voting cards? And Lopez Obrador, I understand, had observers at every single polling place. It may be too early to have evidence of real voter fraud, but do you know if there were any serious election irregularities on the ground yesterday?
Yeah, well, and as I mentioned, voter fraud can happen well before the day of the election.
Sure.
I think there were many observers, and it was very important. One of the best things that we've seen during this election is citizen involvement, both through the student movement that began to challenge that the Mexican elections were not an even playing field from well before the date of the voting, and then also the mobilization by the parties and by the Federal Institute itself to have observers at the polls. This is a big change from the past and will be very important as we begin to sort through exactly what happened. But in the whole run-up period and yesterday, there have been very serious reports of fraud. And vote buying, the one you mentioned, is probably the most important. What happens there is with these debit cards or with the grocery cards and also through cash payments, people who, first of all, are in great need, who are having a lot of trouble supporting their families, and that's a story that's very common in Mexico. Poverty and extreme poverty grew by the millions during the PAN government. It's pretty easy to convince them to sell their vote. Because in the second place, they don't have much of a culture of democracy. They lived under a one-party system for 71 years, and they're very accustomed to the fact that the vote goes to whoever offers the most. And that's not in terms of proposals for the country, but in terms of actual material goods to the voter. Hmm. So this is very, very widespread. There's evidence of it not just in Mexico State, the stronghold where there's a lot of evidence out, but also throughout the country. And the other two major forms of irregularities that we've seen are the media, where The Guardian and other news media, beginning with here in Mexico, brought out that Peña Nieto had been buying favorable coverage from years back, and that the Televisa, the largest television media conglomerate, was actively working to promote his candidacy, not just through paid spots, but in a general strategy to promote him. And so the vote buying in the media were very important. And then the last thing was the way that they exceeded the campaign spending limits, particularly, of course, the PRI. And there's many that still has to be kind of tabulated. But it was very obvious that those were exceeded, and that, again, makes it impossible to call it a completely fair election.
What was the turnout like in yesterday's election? I understand leading up to the election, it was a very huge turnout expected. I mean, particularly by American standards, 70 to 80% of eligible voters were expected to turn out.
Well, 63% is the statistic that we have here, and that's a good turnout. That means that it's grown in quite a bit since the last elections. It's not an historic turnout. There are times when over 70% of the Mexican population would vote, But there was a lot of interest, and the turnout was really very good. And as I say, the level of citizen involvement in these elections was good.
We're going to be in a few minutes hearing from a student activist in Mexico with the Yo Soy 132 movement. But with me still is Laura Carlson, director of the Mexico City-based Americas program of the Center for International Policy. She's also a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus, and we're talking about yesterday's presidential elections in Mexico. What is the independent media saying about what happened yesterday in Mexico? I mean, certainly we can't expect to have unbiased coverage from the major networks, including Televisa. But is there any critical coverage now emerging?
Yeah, there has been some critical coverage. There's been some critical coverage since before the elections and all day yesterday. And essentially, it's going against the current, because there's a huge effort to say Mexico won with these elections. Doesn't matter who the winning candidate is. They were peaceful. They were fair. The president of the PRI came out and said that the elections were carried out with absolute legality, and that's simply not true. The degree of violations of the electoral law throughout the country are high. There's literally thousands of reports from citizens that have been taken formally by the Electoral Crimes Division and the tribunal, the electoral tribunals, and also informally by citizen groups throughout the country, because they've taken up that job for the last couple months, especially since the IM-132 movement began.
Well, finally, Laura, just the fact that you've been observing this election and seen other elections in play, is it possible to say that had there been no election irregularities, or at least minimal election irregularities, that López Obrador would have likely won the election?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that, but I would certainly say that it's possible that there could have been another outcome. I think that vote buying in particular was that extensive. It's always true that people in democracies, and especially at the urging of the media, will vote for a candidate for superficial reasons, and Peña Nieto fits the bill of this kind of soap opera, good looks, suave person who can be attractive as a consumer product to audiences. However, in this case, people not only voted for the wrong reasons, say, but they also voted for wrong reasons that are strictly illegal, which include the vote buying and the secret contracts with the media. So we're talking about a serious situation in which I don't think anybody could say how the results would have changed or if the results would have changed, but you can definitely say, in my opinion, that the acts of fraud and of manipulation in these elections were widespread enough that they've created serious stain on the electoral process and on the election of Peña Nieto himself.
Well, Laura Carlson, I want to thank you, as always, for joining us and giving us an insight from south of the border. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Laura Carlson is director of the Mexico City-based Americas program of the Center for International Policy. She's also a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. We now turn to Miguel, who is a student activist with the Yo Soy 132 movement, talking to us from the camp at the Revolution Monument in Mexico City. Welcome to Uprising, Miguel.
Thank you very much.
Well, first, what is your reaction to the election results last night, and what is the general reaction from students in Mexico?
Well, the general reaction, not only from students, but also from the whole people, is anger. Maybe that's the word. Indignation. We can't believe what is happening. We can't believe that besides all the information that we have, and despite of all of the denouncements and all of the different irregular things that we saw yesterday, all the media, and specifically the institution that was supposed to regulate all these elections, they are saying that everything was clean, everything was clear as water, that there was nothing to think that there was a fraud, that there was that everything was normal, and that they made sure that everything happened like that. And we know that it didn't happen like that. We have a lot of different witnesses of things that were not normal. So that's pretty much the word, I think, anger would describe what people is feeling here. Some are disappointed as well. Some were thinking that maybe change was possible. Maybe a change was going to happen yesterday. But, some of us already knew that the fraud was imminent. So, there's a lot of things that people are feeling here, but I would stay with that word, anger, maybe.
Can you describe the relationship between the Yosoy 132 movement and the campaign for Manuel López Obrador?
Well, as a movement, we always said that we were not supporting anybody in specific. We didn't have a specific party to vote for. We didn't receive any support from any of the parties, because that's what they were thinking. Because maybe because we were against Peña Nieto, maybe we were for somebody else. But that's not the case. We were not working with them. We were not with them. And we are just independent. We started to work as a group of students, and well, of course, a lot of people started to identify themselves with the movement and with the ideals, with the cause that we are trying to reach. But that does not mean that we are supported by them or that we support them as well.
Finally, tell us about where you are at right now. There's a camp at the Revolution Monument in Mexico City. How long have students been camping? And is there a plan to continue protest? You said that there's anger. Is that anger going to be channeled into any kind of mass protest?
Okay. I am part of the camp. I have been here for already a week. And this started last week on Sunday at 6 p.m. And, it started as a little group. Now we are a whole group of people working yesterday to monitor the elections. We were around 120 people maybe working, just working, plus all the people that was here, working as external people, as volunteers that came and as I told you before, they felt identified with the movement and with the cause, and they stayed and worked with us yesterday. So, what we are going to do is, as a movement, we have pronounced ourselves against Peña Nieto, as I told you. We are not going to acknowledge him as the president. And the decision as a group, as 132 movement, are going to be made on the 4th of July, that's Wednesday. There's going to be a general assembly with all the schools, and they are all going to decide together what we are going to do from now on. There's a group of people that will meet at the Estela de Luz. It's a place on the Avenue of Reforma at 2 p.m., and they are going to come from there to the monument, to the Revolution Monument. And that is one of the actions that they will perform just today. But of course, there's a lot of things that the people want to do. As I told you before, people felt a lot of disappointment and anger yesterday. And they want to go out to the street. They want to express themselves. They want to make known to all the people that we are still alive, that we are still on fire, and that we are not going to stay quiet. Mm. So we have not made decisions yet that will happen on Wednesday. But, as I told you, there's a lot of social movement here.
Well, Miguel, I want to wish you the best of luck, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Miguel is a student activist with the Yo Soy 132 movement, talking to us live from the camp at the Revolution Monument in Mexico City, where many other students are camping out and have been for the past week. We've been talking about the Mexico election. Special thanks to Jose Benavides. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we'll hear from author J.R. Helton about his new book, Drugs. And finally, we'll take a look at the coup that took place last week in Paraguay. Stay tuned.
This is Bernard Duncan, General Manager, KPFK Los Angeles. On Friday morning at 10, it's time for another KPFK General Manager's Report to the Listener. I'll have a brief rundown of what's been going on at the station over the past month and tell you about some of our plans for the next little while. I want to hear from you too on Friday with your questions and comments on 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Join me at 10 on Friday morning for the latest Report to the Listener and your calls right here on 90.7 FM KPFK.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. A new study in Britain has revealed that at least 1 million people go to their workplaces each day having taken illegal narcotics. The most common drugs found in people were cannabis, opiates, and cocaine. And even more shockingly, the numbers of drug users are up 43% compared with a previous study in 2007. When broken down by age, the data showed that people between 25 and 34 years of age were most likely to be on drugs at work. Now, a new book by author J.R. Helton provides a contemporary commentary on modern-day drug use. Using his own personal experiences, his book, simply titled Drugs, is a story of Jake, what Helton calls a functional drug user in America. Jake's experiences with a myriad of narcotics is not the typical cautionary morality tale. Neither is it a recklessly euphemistic story of the glory of drug use. Rather, it is a commentary on how America's rampant drug use uncomfortably coexists with a national denial of a cultural and pervasive fondness for drugs. The cover art for J.R. Helton's Drugs is by the celebrated artist and illustrator Robert Crum. Crum says, J.R. Helton really speaks to me, starkly, honestly, darkly funny, acutely observant, and captures the tragic absurdity of human life. He's right up there with the best of them. J.R. Helton is a lecturer at the University of Texas, San Antonio. His earlier books include Below the Line and Man and Beast. He now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising, J.R. Helton.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Yes. Well, tell us about the character that you write about in your book, entitled simply Drugs.
Yes.
How much of the character is based on reality and on your own personal experiences?
Pretty much all of it. Characters have been created and amalgamations of real people, and all the dialogue is fictionalized, but most all of it is based on my experiences. So Jake Stewart is essentially me. So this is a novel, but it's based on a lot of my own personal experiences. So it's maybe a fictionalized memoir might even be a better way to call it.
So then judging from that, you've done a lot of drugs.
Yes,
in your life.
Absolutely. Okay. That's one of the points that I make. But although I think that I'm just being honest about my drug intake over the years, and that actually there are people that are functioning quite well in society that have done many more drugs than I have. For instance, I read last night at Book Soup from the mushroom section, mushroom chapters, which I took three times when I was at 40 years of age, which is much different than taking it when you're 20 at a concert or something, in the spirit of Huxley, for trying to, consciousness expansion. But I never, I have no desire to take them again. I got what I wanted from them. I've never taken LSD and I have no desire to whatsoever. But I've taken a lot of different drugs over the course of my life. And I'm a very successful individual. I'm doing quite well. And that's one of the points of my book also, I'm trying to strike a blow somewhat against the war on drugs, and that this book was actually kind of difficult to get published because most all drug memoirs fall within this, what I believe is a war on drugs propaganda narrative. And this is, you can just check this out easily and find it. All of them have to be written with the person. Basically, they've ruined their life, or it starts with them. They've ruined their life. They've taken so many drugs. They've ended up in rehab and they've stolen from people, or they basically end up repentant and apologetic at the end. And or on their knees needing help in 12-step program or for, you know, looking to God or religion for help. And my book does not end that way at all. And it ends with me in taking drugs still in moderation somewhat at the very end.
So would you say that your book justifies drug use?
It could, but it's mostly a lot of the experiences are negative. So it's not – and that's – I believe that the whole debate in the country is this false paradigm of sort of either-or construct. Are you sober or are you not sober? Are you for drugs or are you against drugs? Are you Republican or are you Democrat? And I think that bounds thought and it bounds true argument and trying to talk about these issues in an intelligent way. So drugs have their positives, as I say. The other, you know, people.
What are the positives of drugs?
They give you pleasure. Otherwise, people wouldn't be taken. They allow you to escape from your mundane reality of your day-to-day existence. I used a quote from Huxley, who's one of the most famous intellectuals in the world, who took mescaline to expand his consciousness. And this is from The Doors of Perception. And he says that most men and women lead lives at worst so painful, at the best so monotonous, poor, and limited, that the urge to escape, the longing to transcend themselves, if only for a few moments, is and always been one of the principal appetites of the soul. I think it's in human nature to want to imbibe some sort of intoxicant, whether it's a bark or a cactus or a weed or an alcoholic beverage.
Is it in human nature, or is it that our society has created so little satisfaction in people and so much pain that drugs are being used as an escape?
I think that's a good question. I think it's a combination of both. But obviously, you have to look at American society itself. The fact that we are the largest drug consumer nation in the world, and yet we have this very highest standards of living in the world. So why this need to be so drugged up? Why this need to escape reality so much in this country? And then, of course, we have this huge, what I believe is a racket, a gigantic racket, which is a war on drugs, which I think is class warfare on the working people of this country. And it's got what do we have? 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of the world's prisoners. There's 2.3 million people in jail, and over 50% of that is because of drug possession or distribution. Most of that. So we have jails filled with people because of this war on drugs. It could be a consequence of your horrible job, or whatever. But I think that also it is part of human nature, and you can find it in any society in the world. It's part of our existence.
Other societies where drug use is more common than others, and is there a correlation that one can find between sort of life satisfaction and drug use?
Well, I know that in more progressive societies than our own, like a country like Holland, they've managed to decriminalize cannabis, which is one of the biggest problems with the war on drugs. That's where the big, huge profits come from. The violence on the border in Mexico, a big part of that's because of cannabis. Mm-hmm. And they've managed to make drugs boring, make cannabis at least boring there in Holland.
And they are one of the countries that have a pretty strong social safety net.
Exactly.
And high standards of living.
Exactly. And they've made it so that it's not the taboo in a way, so that they don't want to. Kids might not want to try it as much, but also they have less use than we do. So they have access to it.
So it's legal, it's available.
It's totally available.
It's decriminalized, but it's used less.
It's used less than in America, right. And so, and I think that it definitely is linked to a lack of social safety net in our society. Instead of getting help or rehab, you're thrown into prison. You're thrown into jail, especially if you don't have money and can't get a lawyers and access to lawyers.
I'm speaking with J.R. Helton about his book, Drugs. He calls it a fictionalized memoir. He lectures at UT San Antonio and has been writing for 30 years. He's published a number of short stories. Now, the protagonist in your book, Jake, which is loosely based on yourself, or maybe not so loosely, he's described as a functional drug user in America. What is a functional drug user? Is that as opposed to somebody who's so addicted that they they can't function?
Yeah. I talk about the difference between dependency and addiction because I think that I quote Dr. Thomas Saws, the famous iconoclastic psychiatrist, who basically says that the word addiction itself is just a word that's just really created for social control, and that we don't go around calling FDR a drug addict, you know, or Churchill, all right, even though both of them were addicted to alcohol in Churchill's case, and then FDR nicotine, all right. So this whole this word addict is a loaded word anyway, I believe. And then there's dependency is when one becomes physically dependent upon a drug. And by the way, this is printed on your – I was dependent upon hydrocodone for years after I broke my back, which is Vicodin. It says on the sheet there that you know, these drugs can engender dependency, and then it can lead to addiction even. So what I would say is addiction, if we are going to use that term, would be when you can't control yourself any longer. You're not functioning at your job anymore. You can't – getting the drug is your number one priority to the point that you might commit crimes and to get money, to get more of the drug. You've lost all self-control completely. Dependency means that when I broke my back, I was taking this Vicodin, all right, which is basically like a suburban heroin now in this country.
Right.
And but I was, you know, when I first took it, I lost a little bit of control and chased the high for a while, and I talk about that in the book. But then I got it under control myself, and then you can just take it up as it's needed for your pain, for chronic pain. And as long as you don't take more than you're supposed to, then you can just function just fine. I would say someone that drinks in moderation is a functional drug user. All right. Or someone
but
that
we don't
smokes weed.
We don't label ourselves that way. People who might drink red wine 4 or 5 times a week.
Absolutely, which
would
a lot
be
of
a
people
functional,
do.
Functional.
We don't call it we
you don't
say
you're
alcohol
a functional
and
alcohol.
Drugs. Right. Right. And but people smoke cannabis too. I know people that they're very smart, successful, intelligent people, and they do that in their when they want to, you know.
And so what's the difference between somebody who goes from being functional to not being functional, somebody who goes from being a user to being an addict, if minus the loaded aspects of it?
I think because you get the pleasure, the dopamine or the endorphins, and that it's hitting those pleasure points in your brain that it's only natural in a way to want to chase that high and to experience such bliss and pleasure, you know. I have a scene in the very beginning. I was a young man. It's the only time I ever did heroin. I smoked. Well, Jake smokes a little bit of heroin. And that sense of bliss and floating away, no care in the world for a troubled teenager, there's no denying that feeling that one gets. If someone takes Demerol going into the hospital or a morphine drip if they're, you know, and they're under care, I'm saying, in a hospital, the pleasure is undeniable, what they feel. Unless they become nauseous or something like that, this floating away of all care, all worry,
but it's not real.
Problems. Yeah, I talk – right. And you can't sustain a life – I say that in the book, that you can't sustain this sort of life. You can't live your whole life high, you know, on any drug, especially opiates. You develop a tolerance to opiates. That's the worst thing about – one of the worst things about them besides the physical hard side effects of withdrawing from them. But – you know, I say in the book that J. Paul Geddes Jr. Was a heroin addict, you know, the fellow who built your museum out here or whatever. And he couldn't keep himself in enough opiates and enough heroin. I mean, imagine this guy, you know, son of one of the most wealthy robber barons in the world, and he couldn't get enough of it. So what makes you think that the average heroin addict on the street is going to ever be able to maintain enough? They won't, you know.
Well, there seems to be, and this is anecdotal on my part, there seems to be a higher than average prevalence of drug use, and using the term drug broadly to include things like alcohol, among creative folks, artists, people who, you know, even architects, et cetera. What does that mean to you? What does that say?
Well, I think it might have something to do with the I talk about in the Mushroom chapters how I used to be an artist, and then I was a scenic artist on films. I used to and then as a writer as well. Maybe this exploratory kind of creative seeking out new experience and the exploratory aspects of being an artist and or as a musician, an open mind, looking for different experiences and new experiences, that might have something to do with it. I think that there might be a link. I read an article once about a link between madness and depression, even to people that are creative as well. And a lot of really creative people and unfortunately writers that I've admired, you know, had people that were either, you know, crazy in their family or they went crazy themselves.
Often the use of substances is hidden. Mm-hmm. Or if it is admitted, it's admitted as something to be terribly ashamed of,
right.
What does that say about American society, a society that criminalizes drugs yet uses more than Holland, which has decriminalized it? Mm-hmm. Is this the sort of shaming or the stigma of drug use? What does that say about American society to you?
Well, I actually believe that the powers that be in this country want people to do drugs. I think they want people to live an escapist life.
Is it a conspiracy or is it?
I think that the whole drug enforcement agency and the federal enforcement of drug laws and all of that is a quite wide out open. This whole war on drugs thing is wide open conspiracy as far as prosecuting this war that I think's misguided.
So it's not that there's people sitting in a room saying we really want people to consume drugs. It's just the policy has evolved that way.
No, I think big
way.
Pharma companies do want people to consume drugs. Absolutely.
And that's prescription pills.
Yeah, absolutely. They wrote over 80 million prescriptions for Vicodin, I believe, last year alone.
Because it makes money.
It makes a lot of money, yeah. And doctors, and then once you get dependent upon it,
you're a consumer for life.
You're a consumer, yeah. They've got you, you know. And but they're encouraged to take you these antidepressants and stuff, which I think are really bad drugs, and they have horrible side effects. I mean, it's ludicrous. There's a new one that they've got a commercial up for now, where it's adding an antidepressant to your antidepressant, and the side effects are horrific. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up.
It's so ludicrous. Yeah, while you're watching the screen having these beautiful, serene images.
Right. But one of the main ones is that you might kill yourself.
Right.
And you can't get more ludicrous than that, all right? So take this antidepressant and then take another one on top of it, but both of them may make you want to kill yourself. I mean, that's insane. And cannabis, for good or bad, and I don't smoke marijuana anymore, but is not addictive, and it certainly doesn't have those kinds of side effects. Now, it might depress some people, but it alleviated depression with me, at least when I smoked it, and had a calming, stress-relieving effect, which I assume is one of the things they're trying to get from an antidepressant, you know.
And so ultimately, how much of our drug policy is tied to corporate greed and making money, and how much is tied to a conservative ideology that comes from a puritanical origin?
Yeah, I mean, those things are tied together, I believe, and it's all about control and keeping the population control. I say at the end of my book that there are all kinds of, you know, I believe that television is a drug as well.
Internet?
Sure, that could. Well, that's just another screen to look at. It's just another avenue for television or escapism. Movies are a drug, I say. Music is a type of drug. To me, music is a very healthy drug. It's a great one to take. But I think television's a very dangerous drug that solely exists pretty much for commerce and to dump people down and to keep people controlled into this consumerism. Consumer-based society and lifestyle where you're not really a human being. You're not even your vote's not valid or anything. You're just there to consume. That's your main primary purpose. So I don't think the government even really wants people to not do drugs. I just think they want them to do their drugs or the big pharmaceutical drugs and that they use the war on drugs, though, as a means of if I can't give people education or give them jobs, let's throw them in jail. And now I'm from Texas, where they, you know, it was the start of the for-profit prison industry. All right, And so they're making a lot of money off of this, on incarcerating people and putting them in jail, entangling them in the legal system. You have millions of people. To me, there's something profoundly wrong with the supposed land of the free having more prisons, more people in prison per capita in America than any other country on the planet. That's insane. That's insanity to me.
Finally, J.R. Hilton, what would an ideal drug policy look like to you in the United States? And would it address issues of, as we were saying, the mundaneness of day-to-day life, the pain of living? Would it look simply the one aspect of Holland, which is decriminalization? Because that's often what we hear from people who talk about progressive drug policies, talk about decriminalization, but they don't necessarily address the fact that Americans work harder more than almost any other people in industrialization. We have less vacation.
Right.
We're struggling. You know,
right.
So what would an ideal drug policy look like to you?
Well, I think that basically, as you said, that I do agree that it should be decriminalized, but that all of them should be. All right. And then it should be regulated by the government.
So regulated like what, cigarettes and alcohol?
Like cigarettes and alcohol.
So
and
that
I think it would
underage
them,
kids don't have access
be able to
them.
Get, yeah, it's easier for a kid to get marijuana than it is to get beer a lot of times. At least it was for me when I was a teenager. You had to get an older person to buy the beer for you. So it's actually it would make it harder for young people to get access to drugs. And then also the purity of them would be somewhat more regulated. So you'd have less overdoses and things like that. I'm not saying use wouldn't probably go up, maybe somewhat, if more people might try. But just because someone might – I mean, if heroin were legal tomorrow, most people aren't going to go out and do it. You know, and even,
because they already know of the effects of heroin.
And even
but
then,
they might try marijuana.
They might – yeah. So what? And even if you do try some of those things, it doesn't mean you're going to become an addict, you know, dependent on it. It actually takes a while to develop a habit. In fact, it's easier to develop a habit on these hydrocodone, these new
the prescription
these
pills.
Prescription yeah. pills. Yeah, they've tweaked them to such a degree they really hit those opiate receptors, you know, very quickly, and doesn't take that long to get dependent on these.
And all you have to do for those is go to your doctor and say you're experiencing pain.
Have insurance, basically. If you have insurance,
health insurance,
then you really are a great customer if you got insurance. But there's a huge underground market of people buying these drugs on the street as well, buying Vicodin, Norco, and things like that. So that's another whole area where people are selling those now too.
Well, J.R. Hilton, what do you hope readers will get out of your book, Drugs?
Well, the number one takeaway from my book that I want people to get is that you have a right to control your own consciousness as a human being, all right? And if you don't, you're not free. That is the main thing I want people to understand. And that if you can't even you don't have the freedom to alter or inhibit or expand or control your own consciousness, and let's say just even in the privacy of your own home, then you're not a free individual. And I think that needs to change.
J.R. Hilton, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
J.R. Hilton is a lecturer at the University of Texas, San Antonio. We've been discussing his book, titled simply Drugs. Its cover art is illustrated by the celebrated artist Robert Crumb. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we will take a look at the coup that took place in Paraguay. Stay tuned.
Is this the end of the beginning or the end? I guess it depends on your perspective, my friend, because it's all connected. Anticipation soon becomes a recollection. See, the end is the beginning, because in the end you find it all starts over again. One door closes and then another opens. A brand new path has been chosen, and now we go in spy versus spy, eye for an eye, blow for blow, toe to toe, do or die, kamikaze, fighter pilot, suicide. Bombers willing to lose their life. Do it for pride, do it for love of the nation. The red, blue, and white, they've drawn the lines, and now you've got to choose a side. It's your duty, right? You gotta
Is This the End by Beat Noir from White Ridge, Colorado. On the web at reverbnation.com/beatsnoir. BEATSNOIR. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Paraguayan activists and journalists are condemning the June 22nd ouster of President Fernando Lugo as a parliamentary coup following a one-day impeachment trial resulting in a 39-4 Senate vote to impeach the reformist leader. The decision brought out protesters in Paraguay's capital, Asunción, where 2,000 people camped out in front of the nation's Congress, while rural farmers and peasant organizations blocked roads in the countryside. Meanwhile, Lugo's removal and his replacement by Vice President Federico Franco has been met with concern and suspicion from other South American governments. Presidents from Argentina, Ecuador, and Venezuela on Friday withheld recognition of the new government, while members of the regional trade bloc Mercosur suspended Paraguay's membership in the organization. The United States State Department, in comments made last week, urged calm, but has yet to issue a definitive reaction to the coup. Writing for The Guardian, U.S. economist Mark Weisbart criticized the tepid U.S. response, saying, quote, "The conclusion is obvious. Any right-wing faction, military or civilian, that can overthrow a democratically elected left-of-center government will get support from the United States government." Lugo, whose 2008 election ended the 60-year reign of the conservative Colorado Party, campaigned on a platform of land reform in a country where just 2% of the population controls over 75% of the arable land. The move to oust Lugo came on the heels of a shootout between peasant farmers and police that killed 17 people. The peasants were occupying land owned by former Colorado Party Senator Blas N. Riquelme, one of Paraguay's richest men. Despite claims by Franco that his rise to power is constitutional, many Paraguayans have expressed fears that Lugo's removal means an end to this generation's chance at democracy. It also casts doubt on the country's ability to resolve its crippling poverty, which afflicts over a third of its population. My guest is Javiera Rulli. She is an Argentinian researcher who has written extensively on Paraguay. She now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Javiera.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm happy to join you, but I will ask you to talk slowly because, yeah,
sure.
I want to really understand the questions.
Absolutely.
I think the accent is surprising me a bit.
Well, how much of what has happened in Paraguay last week has to do with land and particularly has to do with agribusiness? There are some news commentators that are tying what happened in Paraguay to Monsanto, the giant agribusiness company.
Yes, exactly. To understand these links, you have to go to understand what's the role of Paraguay now. Paraguay in the agribusiness sector. Paraguay has more than 3 million hectares of monocultures of soya, of transgenic soya, the variety patented by Monsanto. And Paraguay, despite being a very poor country, it's a perfect paradise for agribusiness, such as Monsanto, Cargill, Bunge, Syngenta, because these companies pay almost no taxes, so they can produce, the land is very cheap, and they can produce and export to Asia and Europe mainly. So when Lugo became an enemy to these corporations, to these interests, because he was promising land reform since the beginning he became a president. Of course, he did not really perform the land reform, so this became more sort of a promise. But there were some ministers that had a contrary position to agribusiness. And the case became, the link is when last year, the Minister of Agriculture authorized the liberation of a transgenic cotton seed, the Bolgar BT, which is produced by Monsanto. So they liberated it for commercial use. However, another minister, which is in charge of the liberation of transgenic seed, he stopped the liberation, declaring it illegal. So this was a contradiction within the government. And he stopped. Since that moment, Monsanto, with other corporations, became an attack and a war against this minister and also the environmental and health minister,
which were rejecting new transgenics to be liberated into the country. Is it clear?
Yes.
The connection?
Yeah. So at this point, would it be fair then to say that those forces involved in the ouster of Lugo are directly linked to agribusinesses like Monsanto? Do they get money from them?
Yeah, what we can say is that the corporations present that are behind the whole model of production of transgenic soya for export, they are directly collaborating with these big states, big landowners. And those are also into the political power of Partido Colorado and Partido Liberal, the two big political parties that made the parliamentary coup, no? So, like what you mentioned, how is it? You mentioned the massacre of Kuruwati, which took place in a big state, in a big land. It's around 2,000 hectares of a politician of Partido Colorado. So these people are connecting with the corporations. So when the government of Lugo were making it difficult for new transgenic seeds, corporations joined these political parties and supported this impeachment, which ended in this parliamentary coup. We believe that because there were no real, let's say, legal reasons to stop the Lugo's government, we believe many that the whole that it was like an operation that started with the Kuruwati massacre. So it was planned to make this eviction and to kill so many, and these policemen that were killed were not killed by the landless peasants, but by people that had infiltrated this group.
So the massacre in Kuruwati, which was on June 15th, resulting in 11 farmers and 6 policemen dead, was seen as sort of the first part of the coup that then ended with the one-day impeachment trial last week of Fernando Lugo. Can you, and when you say transgenic soy being planted in Paraguay, I'm assuming you mean genetically modified soy. What exactly is the situation now? I mean, what has Federico Franco, what have the opposition forces used as a justification? How did they justify to the country why the coup took place? I mean, of course, they don't call it a coup, but how do they explain it?
Well, they're justifying that they are getting back the order. And Franco, the first day of Franco being the new president, he met up with the Union of Production, the UFP, which is linked to this corporation I mentioned, said there is an official discourse about that they have brought back the state of order, but in the streets and in the countryside, the people are demonstrating, but this, you cannot read about that in the big media. I have read and I have been talking with people. I know that there have been more than 30 demonstrations and cutting of roads all over the country. So this is a political interest. The people which have economical interest, they are supporting Franco, while the people in the countryside, the poor people, they are not supporting this. And especially peasant organizations and social movements they fear that the new repression will start. I think not now. It hasn't taken place yet because there are so many international eyes on Paraguay. But very soon, when this international monitoring is over, this new government, this illegal government, will criminalize those movements and those movements that stand for land reform, which are a threat for the big landowners and for the corporations and agribusiness that only take more and more land. The background of this war is like a war between corporations and big landowners against the peasants, is because during the dictatorship that took place in 40 years in Paraguay, lots of land, we are talking about millions of hectares of land, of public land, were given to political allies of Stroessner, of the dictator. So these illegalities have never been solved. So many of those political big politicians today in the Congress, they are descendants of these people. So they are also big landowners, and today, yeah, they are strong businessmen that that produce and supply to Cargill and other grain agribusiness grain companies.
Well, Javiera, really, very briefly, what has the reaction from other governments been, particularly Venezuela and governments in Latin America that have seen and that do have democratic governments and left-leaning governments?
Well, I'm very happy that they have reacted very fast and in a very strong way, rejecting the new situation and impeding Paraguay to participate in the Mercosur. Well, I hope that the measures will go further, because I'm not sure that just with the isolation will be enough to stop this new illegal government.
Well,
several countries have taken back their embassies, which is a strong measure, but I think economical measures should also be taken.
Well, we will certainly continue to monitor the story. I want to thank you, Javiera Rulli, very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Javiera Rulli is an Argentinian researcher. She's written extensively on Paraguay, and we've been talking about the coup that took place there last week. For Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, the physicist Niels Bohr once said, "The best weapon of a dictatorship is secrecy, but the best weapon of a democracy should be the weapon of openness." You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Kevin Walker is our intern. Chris Bennett is our music curator. And Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Visit us online at uprisingradio.org, where you can listen to all of our interviews, rate them, leave comments, share them on Facebook, and find links and events we mention on the air. Send your story ideas to mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I won't be on the air for the next 3 days, but I'll be back live on Friday. I'll see you then at 8.